Hello, I'm Aaron Lohr, and this is the Endocrine News Podcast. For those of us who try to lose weight at some point in time, we know the frustration of losing weight, feeling good about that, only to see that weight return. Why does that weight return? Is the process the same for adults and adolescents? Is there any way to mitigate that weight regain? Joining me today to discuss these issues is Dr. Eric Bomberg, assistant professor at the Center for Pediatric Obesity Medicine at the University of Minnesota. He recently presented an abstract at ENDO 2024 entitled Hormonal and Physiological Changes Following Short-Term Weight Loss in Adolescents with Obesity and the Role of Glucagon-like Peptide 1 Receptor Agonists to Counteract Adaptations. Thank you for being here today, Dr. Bomberg.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Honored to be here. Have the ability to speak at Endocrine Society. It's always a great meeting every year.
Now, nearly everyone that I've talked to who's tried to lose weight, if they've had some success, they seem to experience a period of weight regain. Is that normal? And what drives that process?
That is completely normal.
Oh, good.
I always say that obesity is a very, very complex process. If it was the treatment for obesity, if it was as simple as everything we would have been told in the past, we would have solved the problem a long time ago. But we obviously didn't, right? And so what is that? I think that one of the things that has certainly helped us is that we have better tools. But another one of the major issues is that we have a lot of signals that fight against the weight loss. And for example, and this is obviously meant to be a crazy example, if I were to weigh 1,000 pounds, and then let's say that I lost 100 pounds and now I weigh 900 pounds, my body would think it is starving by that point. And the reason for that is that we have all of these hormones that are in play. GLP-1 is one of those, or glucagon-like peptide 1, which is a hormone that can improve satiety. There's another hormone called GIP. There is one called ghrelin, leptin, amylin, PYY, NPY. The point being is that there are a lot of different hormones that are fighting against the system because our body really wants to maintain homeostasis. So if I weigh 1,000 pounds and I lose 100 pounds, it wants me to go back and weigh 1,000 pounds again. And so all of these hormones kind of kick into overdrive, and they help drive things like increasing hunger, lower fullness, cravings, anything basically related to eating and other behaviors as well, just to make the entire process much less efficient. And that's what makes weight loss maintenance so challenging.
Wow, you make it sound very challenging. I'm not discouraged. I'm still going to go out there and do what I need to do. But you mentioned GLP-1, and you know the big news these days in the world of weight loss are these medications that are focused on glucagon-like peptide 1 or GLP-1, as you were saying. Now, you mentioned a little bit about it. Can you tell us a bit more about the role of GLP-1 in the body naturally, and then why these medications might be so popular?
Yeah, so the role of GLP-1 kind of naturally in the body is it is what's known as satiety or a fullness hormone. So having higher levels of GLP-1 help our body naturally feel more full. So that's kind of what it generally does. Now, what this class of medications does, these GLP-1 agonists, and there are several, they've actually been out on the market in total for about 20 years now. So for a lot longer than people realize. And that is just because the newer medications on the market are the ones that have been far more effective than the older varieties. And therefore, obviously, they've gotten a lot of publicity and they get used quite a lot, and they should be used quite a lot. So these medications do a couple of different actions that can help lead to weight loss. One of those actions is, again, by being an agonist of GLP-1, they basically work in the way that GLP-1 does to improve fullness. That also works by doing something called delaying gastric emptying. That means that it slows down the rate that food leaves your stomach. So in general, if you eat something, food leaves your stomach at some point, and when it does, then it sends signals up to your hypothalamus to tell you, hey, I'm hungry again, right? And so if you can keep the food or keep whatever the substance in your stomach for longer, it can help make you feel fuller for longer. And so that is one of the primary ways that GLP-1 agonists are meant to work. Now, they have also found some additional properties as well over the time. They seem to have some effects in terms of reductions in cravings and other cravings and other kind of behaviors very similar to that as well, where a lot of patients who take these medications just describe that they just kind of feel that these signals to eating and the signals related to food are just kind of quieted down overall.
I can see why that would be such a powerful thing to have access to.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm often wondering, well, what can I snack on or where can I go, right? Let's talk about your research a little bit here at Endo 2024. So your research looks at hormonal and physiological changes after weight loss in obese adolescents and how a GLP-1 receptor agonist may mitigate weight regain first. Why did you choose to focus on adolescents?
Yep. So the primary focus on adolescents, but obviously this is a problem for not just adolescents, but for children and adults. It is the focus of our center at the University of Minnesota. So we are the Center for Pediatric Obesity mm-hmm. Medicine. We've been one of the centers that's really at the forefront of looking at obesity pharmacotherapies, particularly in adolescents and, of course, in children as well. So that's the primary focus on adolescents, is just fits in with our mission.
Why don't we dig into your study? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you did?
Yeah, so this was actually part of a larger trial that was funded by the NIH that was meant to look at kind of the overall study design is that there was 100 children that chose to participate. We always thank our participants for participating in these studies. We know that they're long and it's extremely important to us, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so the first part of the study was to induce some amount of weight reduction. And that number was chosen to be 5%. So a 5% BMI reduction. That was done for a period of about 4 to 8 weeks for most people. And it was done through the use of meal replacements. And by meal replacements, we mean just kind of prepackaged foods. They were around 1,400 calories a day, and they were provided to all participants.
Okay.
Now, there was 100 that originally started, and 66 out of those 100 were able to achieve that 5% body mass index reduction, because we were looking here at then what happens during the maintenance phase is what mm-hmm. we were looking at happening. So then of those 66, half of them were then randomized to get a placebo. And the other half of them were randomized to get one of the earlier GLP-1 receptor agonists called exenatide. And we'll talk a little bit here about why that one in specific was chosen. And then they were followed out through the course of a year to kind of see what happens in terms of, does this seem to have some sort of an effect? And so for this particular part of the project, we measured a number of the different hormones. We also measured resting metabolic rate at various time points. And so those various time points included before the weight loss, right after that short-term weight loss, and then at 6 and 12 months.
You teed up my next question wonderfully, exenatide. Why?
So good question. So there are exenatide, admittedly, is not the most efficacious medication in terms of weight management. Now, exenatide is actually approved for use for type 2 diabetes. It's not actually approved for use for weight management, both for pediatrics or adults. And the average weight loss with this medication is not great. Somewhere in the ballpark of 1% over about 30 weeks, if you actually extrapolate the numbers on the adult data. But one of the important things I think to remember with a lot of these sort of studies is that the conception of the study was a long time before it actually came to publication. So when you're writing the grant, when you're putting in all the proposals, when you're coming up with all of the ideas, and then it takes 5 years to do a study, that was the option that was available at that time. So had we repeated this, we probably would have chosen one of the newer medication options, such as semaglutide, for example. But that was what was available at that time.
No, it makes perfect sense. Now, I'm sure everybody listening is wondering, well, get to the point. What did you find? What happened?
So in general, what we found is some changes in terms of those hormones that occurred during short-term weight loss, which is what we would have expected. And so we found some of the hormone levels altered themselves in a way that would promote weight gain. And that did happen during that short-term weight loss. And then there was a few changes, but overall, exenatide, I would say, did not have that much of an effect. But there was a couple of changes on some of the hormones that are meant to help with weight gain. It altered those hormones to lessen those, if that makes sense. But the effects overall, I would say, were relatively small.
Now, were the findings that you got what you expected all the way through, or is there anything in there that maybe surprised you a little bit?
It did not surprise me in retrospect, looking back and saying, these hormone levels that are meant to promote weight gain, There would be some minor changes that happen during a short-term weight loss. There would be some minor, and a medication like exenatide might affect some of those hormones in a way to lessen that weight regain. That does not surprise me that that did happen, but I think it's important to remember the context. And the context here being that the relative amount of weight loss that was done during the short-term period is relatively low. So 5% BMI reduction, I guess the question would be is what if instead of a 5% BMI reduction, it was 10 or 15 or 20 or 30% BMI reduction? For example, if this was done in patients who had underwent metabolic bariatric surgery, we likely, because this was seen on the adult side in the adult studies, would have seen much further alterations in some of these hormones. And then if we were to instead have selected a medication that was much more potent than exenatide, for example, semaglutide 2.4 milligrams daily, also known as Wegovy, or a medication called tirzepatide, also known as Mounjaro or Zepbound. These are much more potent medications. So if we would have replaced this and redone this study with much more initial weight loss and then a much more potent medication afterwards, I think that the effects would have been much greater.
Are there other things you would want to look at that way? And downstream, if that research is accomplished, how might it impact clinical care, you think, downstream?
Yeah, so I think obviously future studies should be looking at this sort of question, I believe, in situations that are much more extreme than the situation that was here, which is, for example, after metabolic bariatric surgery or after a more significant weight reduction initially and with a much more powerful medication. I think the results definitely would have been different and would have mirrored more of some results that have been seen after The Biggest Loser, for example, which was a famous paper that was published back in New England Journal on kind of these hormonal alterations that happened after things like The Biggest Loser. Clearly, looking at that sort of stuff is the next step. But what I do believe very strongly in is that after one does have weight loss, these hormones do kick up in a way to promote weight regain. Your metabolism, your metabolic rate, it doesn't come back to the way that it was previously. And because of that, it just makes it far more likely for people to gain weight again. And I think from a clinical side point, especially for people who have had things like metabolic or bariatric surgery or lost a lot of weight, whatever it happens to have been from, that maintenance is the hard part. And that oftentimes medications or other things may be needed during that maintenance period. And so I think that that's kind of one of the major, I would say, clinical take-home points from this.
Makes total sense. I wanted to thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your work with us. This is a fascinating topic, and I'm sure we're just going to keep learning more.
Absolutely. I wanted to thank the Endocrine Society, put on another great meeting. It's been excellent. Always great to come to these conferences, network, meet with other people, see all the new research that's going on in a wide variety of areas.
I love it. Thank you so much, Dr. Bomberg.
That's all for this episode. I hope you enjoyed hearing from Dr. Bomberg. Before we go, I want to let you know about a new and exciting upcoming event from the Endocrine Society called the AI in Healthcare Virtual Summit. Whether you want to learn more about how AI technologies are redefining diagnostics, treatment planning, and patient outcomes, or you want to explore machine learning algorithms and predictive analytics, this meeting is for you. It's all online and will take place on November 8th through the 9th. We'll include a link for it in today's episode description. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Endocrine News Podcasts are a free service of the Endocrine Society. To learn more or to become a member, visit the Society's website at www.endocrine.org.